His glory, His divine story. Every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Size Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m. Sai Ram. Loving salutations at the lotus feet of Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, the voice, the ears, the heart and soul of Radio Sai, and also its executive producer, director and supreme manager. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to Thursday Live. You're tuned to our Asia stream and we are coming to you live from Prashanthi Nilayam, Andhra Pradesh, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. My name is Karuna and I will be hosting this segment called Morning Glory. And I want to thank you for staying with us on this fine Thursday morning, April the 19th, 2018. We are coming to you from the Radio Sai Studios where the current time is exactly 40 minutes past 9 a.m. That is Indian Standard Time. And the current weather conditions in the Divine Valley call for clear skies and occasional cloud cover and the possibility of a thunderstorm, I believe, and I hope that is true. Current temperature is at 33 degrees Celsius, and we are expecting afternoon highs of a balmy 40 degrees Celsius, and somewhat cooler evenings and overnight temperature at a still sultry 27 degrees Celsius. But whether our weather is hot, cold or humid, the inner climate here is always pretty pleasant. That, dear listeners, is the divine magic of this abode of supreme peace, which houses the holiest of shrines on the face of this planet, the Mahasannidhi of Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba. To the sacred energy that emanates from that holy seat, we bow with reverence and heartfelt love and deep gratitude. Bolo Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba Ji Ki Jai. In a few days from now, that is exactly 5 days, on Tuesday of next week, April 24, 2018, the world will descend here in Prashanthi, India, to offer their respects to the Master whose glory and wisdom has touched our lives and blessed us so deeply and practically drowned us all in His love. April 24th is the day the finite form of God assumed His infinite glory. Poignant moments like these bring us all together as one family, the family of Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, for each one of us is His son and daughter. I hope you're all packed up to come home to Prashanthi Nilayam on that day, dear sisters and brothers. And if for any reason you're not able to join us, make sure you attend your Samiti or Sai Center Seva activities to honor that day, because the best way to express our gratitude to Bhagwan is to follow in His footsteps. And Bhagwan has taught us this simple mantra that service to the needy is the best way to serve and please God. Coming up on Morning Glory today, the Canadian content continues and I'm so happy about it. Part 1 of Tryst with Divinity with the lawyer from Ontario, Canada, Mr. Bernard Kugelman. He's in conversation with my colleague, Radio Sai's very own Bishu Prushti. Today I will bring you part 1 of this interview and you can catch part 2 right here, same place, same time next week. But first, please allow me to pose a question to our listeners this morning. And my question is as follows, always about history. I like to jog your memory. Now, can you please name the campus of the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, which first started as a college that was affiliated to the Sri Venkateshwara University of Tirupati? Another holy place, right? Tirupati. So which campus of the SSIHL, the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning, was started as a college that was originally affiliated to the Sri Venkateshwara University, I beg your pardon, or the SV University in Tirupati in its early years, before we became a university ourselves, a deemed university. Please email me your answers ASAP at the following email ID, karuna@radiosai.org. That will be karuna@radiosai.org. And I will wait for your answers, and I will gladly announce the names of those who got the answer right on Morning Glory just today on the other side of the interview, which is Trisway Divinity with Mr. Bernard Kugelman. So start thinking, figuring out which campus of the current Satyasai University originally started as a college that was affiliated to the SV University at Tirupati in its early years. I'm looking forward to your answers at karuna@radiosai.org. And I will announce all your names on the other side of this interview. Coming up now, Mr. Bernard Kugelman of Ontario, Canada, in conversation with Bishop Rushdie. Here is part one. Have a listen, please.
Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to Tryst with Divinity, our series of conversations with people who have been touched by the love of Bhagwan. And today, Swami has sent to the studios Mr. Bernard Kugelman. He is someone who has been in the Sai fold from the West, from Canada, since the 70s, and he was instrumental in setting up of the Satya Sai Center, one of the Satya Sai Centers in Toronto, along with a few other devotee brothers and sisters. He's someone who has been coming to Prashantanilayam almost every year since the early 80s, and was fortunate even to be blessed with a room in the ashram. That is how Swami facilitated him to make his visits to Parthi as often as he can. And just like so many devotees who converge in Prashantanilayam to spend that sacred night of Shivaratri in this sacred hamlet of the Shiva Shakti Swarupa. He was one of the devotees who was here for the Mahashivaratri celebrations this year, which we celebrated just a week ago. Today is February 19th, 2018. And after that, he stayed on. So every time he's in Prashantanilayam, he's here at least for 3-4 weeks. And we're really grateful to Bhagwan that he could make time and come to the studios to share his journey of how he was pulled into the Sai consciousness and what this consciousness has done to him over these 30-40 years. So with grateful pranams at his lotus feet, we begin this conversation with prayers. So a warm welcome to you, Mr. Bernard, to the studios of Radio Sai.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So you are someone who has seen Bhagwan way back in the 70s. You have seen how this place has changed. You have seen how the Sai movement has grown. You have seen how the Sai movement sort of was in its initial years in Canada. So maybe you should share the story of how Bhagwan put these pieces together for the Sai movement to start in Canada, because you were so much in the thick of it at that point in time.
Yes, I suppose the story really starts when I was a youngster, because I was born into a family where I wasn't religious at all, but I was, from the time I was small, I was always sort of questioning my existence and, you know, looking up in the sky and seeing the stars and everything like that, you know. And so I always had a lot of questions, but I didn't have a lot of answers. I eventually became a lawyer and in Toronto, and I started practicing criminal law, defense law, in 1967. So I'm still doing that now, even after I'm in my 51st year of practice.
Wow.
Thanks to Swami, I think a lot of credit, most credit must go to him. And so what happened was that in 1975, after I'd been in practice for about 8 years, I was in an office with about a half a dozen other criminal lawyers. We were associated. And I always loved to travel. Like, before that, I had always gone. From the time I was a teenager, I traveled all over the place, usually backpacking. And so I had an opportunity to get away, and I thought I would like to go on a world trip. Mm-hmm. And I had these other lawyers that were associated with me so they could babysit my law practice, and I planned to be away for about 6 months, which mm-hmm. in actual fact isn't that long in a criminal practice. Not a lot happens, or often, you know, it's slow. So what happened was that I bought a kind of a round-the-world ticket, and I started off in Hawaii, and I worked my way through the islands of the Pacific down, and I ended up in New Zealand at a hostel. And when you're backpacking like that, and I was doing that even though I was a lawyer, I still did the backpacking route, which is sort of, you know, the economy way of traveling. But since I was a lawyer, I also was able to sort of every once in a while check into a nice hotel and have a nice hot bath. So I met this hostel in New Zealand at Mount Cook, where there's this famous glacier. And when you're backpacking around like that, you meet other travelers, and you're always comparing notes about, you know, he's coming one way, I'm going the other way, you know, what places are good to visit, you know, historical sites, tourist sites, restaurants, you know, things like that, okay? These are the important things. And so I meet this young fellow there, and we're comparing notes, except that we're not comparing notes, because when I ask him about, you know, he's coming from India, and that was my final destination, was India, before I went back home. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in comparing notes, but he just started talking about this holy man in India. And, you know, he started telling stories about, you know, materializing things out of thin air and making the blind see and, you know, curing cancer canceled and raising the dead, you know. And I would have dismissed him as a complete crackpot. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there was the slightest suggestion that, you know, he was a hippie on drugs or something like that, you know, I wouldn't have paid any attention to what he said whatsoever. Mm. But my recollection is that he was a medical student returning from India to the United States, mm-hmm. and he was an intelligent young man, and when he spoke, he made perfect sense, like I had been defending serious cases for 8 years mm-hmm. and dealing with witnesses all the time, mm-hmm. and he was a good witness. He was a good witness, mm-hmm. but I couldn't really know. I didn't know whether he was a screwball or whether he might have been telling the truth. That's really what it boiled down to. But he was sincere, and he seemed to be telling the truth as far as he knew it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really make much of it. I just kind of, you know, filed it away in the back of my mind, and it didn't really amount to much. So that was in New Zealand. And so I make my way through Asia.
Were you looking for any spiritual master or anything like
nothing,
that?
Nothing.
You were only seeking some answers. That's
all. No, I wasn't even seeking answers. I was just taking
at that point in time.
I was just enjoying travel.
Traveling. But as a child, you had some questions.
It was always in the back of my mind.
Back of your mind.
It was always in the back of my mind. And probably, like with hindsight, you know, my sort of strong impulse to travel was sort of like seeking, you know, even though I didn't know what I was looking for.
Okay. Eh? But you'd end up in religious places and things
When you're traveling, you're going into churches, temples, yes. You're going to museums, you're going into all kinds of things. I mean,
you're not really looking for someone. Or
no, no, I wasn't looking. I was looking for, you know, the things that travelers look for, you know, nice tourist sites, nice beaches, you know, things like that, you know. And so, The next thing that happens is, like, I make my way through much of Asia, a whole bunch of countries there, and I come to Indonesia, a place called Yogyakarta, on the island of Java, and I go to this ancient temple of Prambanan, which is a big tourist site in that part of the world. So it's an ancient Hindu temple, probably 1,000 or more years old. And so I'm going there as a tourist, that's all. I mean, I'm not going there, you know, looking for anything specific. Mm-hmm. And there was another very, very famous temple site not too far from there, a Buddhist site, Borobudur.
Yes.
Which is also very, very amazing place.
Yes.
So I go to Prambanan, and I'm walking around, and they have these different temples there. And it's quite a fantastic place. I mean, the temples are well preserved, and it sort of reminds one of, like, Angkor Wat. Like, I've never been there, but I think it's sort of like a miniature version of Angkor Wat, in a sense. And so I go into these different chambers where they have statues of gods.
Yes.
And I'm looking, you know, I don't have a clue who they are or what's going on, but well,
you have no introduction to even Hindu gods.
No, Hindu gods.
Because I think there you have Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara.
You have
in Prambanan.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Like there's one major temple where there are four chambers, one facing each direction.
Yes.
And you have Brahma and Vishnu and Shiva and Ganesha.
Ganesha.
I didn't know Ganesha from a hole in the ground at that time. So I go into this one chamber. You go up these stone steps, so, you know, very old steps, and you go into this chamber. It's not very big. It's maybe 10 feet by 10 feet or something. And there's this big statue there, of a half man, like a man with a head of an elephant.
Mm.
That's what I saw. Mm. I saw a man with the head of an elephant.
At that point in time, that is what...
That's what I saw.
Yeah.
I had never heard of Ganesha.
Mm.
I had never heard of practically anything. I wasn't religious in terms of my upbringing. I never paid a lot of attention to it.
Mm.
I was immersed in worldly things, you know, like practicing law, doing what you do.
Mm.
And so... I looked at this statue of this elephant man, and all of a sudden I was like frozen I stood there like standing. I became like a statue, and I'm a statue with my eyes bugging out of my head, like just staring intently at this statue. And I'm just staring, and I'm like hypnotized by it. I can't take my eyes off it. And then I feel impelled to go up to the statue and hug it, like put my arms around it.
Oh.
And that's what I did. And I did that.
Oh. Oh my God.
And then I came out of there, and I went back onto the compound, you know, outside of that temple. And I couldn't believe what just happened. Like I was scratching my head. Like nothing like that had ever happened to me.
Yeah, I mean, why did you do it? I mean, there's some pull there.
There was certainly, but I didn't. It was strictly from the subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Like it came from somewhere, mm-hmm. but it was not conscious whatsoever. It was just something that came over me, and I had to do it, but I didn't know why. And so I came.
But how was the feeling after that when you did that?
The feeling was one of. Like what happened?
Oh.
What was that about?
Mm.
I was standing outside there, and I'm saying to myself, what was that about?
It's like a different. You went and did something, and now you're trying to analyze what happened and
what
is the purpose of all this, or what is all this basically?
It wasn't even like I was trying to analyze it because I couldn't. I had nothing to analyze it with.
Mm.
It was just sort of a kind of a strange, bizarre incident that happened to me.
Mm.
And when I came out of there, you know, I was just sort of standing there for a minute, just sort of trying to take it in. And then life goes on. So then, you know, I'm going about my business and, you know, doing what I'm doing and, you know, go back to Jakarta, you know, and continue traveling. I ended up in Bali at that time, and that was a beautiful place. And that was the only other contact I had with the elephant god was in Bali in a place called Badulu. There's something called the Elephant Cave. It's, you know, in Indonesian, it's a different word, different name. But it's like this temple carved out of the rock, and it's dedicated to who I now know as Ganesha. I didn't know then, and it has in it like a statue of Ganesha, but not a big one, like just a kind of a smallish type of statue, and then they have carved into the rock, they have these kind of niches carved out of the rock where the monks or whoever used to be there, and that's also like 1,000 years old or more, whoever used to be there would meditate in that cave, in that Ganesha cave.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in there. That was the only, I had that contact in Bali shortly after Prambanan. And then, again, when I was in that cave though, in that place, it was nothing special to me. It was just a tourist site. You know, it didn't conjure up anything at all. Nothing weird, nothing unusual. So I continue my travels, and shortly after that, I end up in Calcutta, and I'm walking. There's this big sort of old British government complex, and there's this great big parkland there. And this young Indian man, he kind of befriended me. You know, when you're traveling like that, a lot of people try to befriend you. Most of them I just, you know, slough off because I'm not interested. You know, they're trying to sell you something. They're trying to do something. But he wasn't like that. He was very different. Like he was a young man, maybe early 20s. And he spoke like an English poet. Like his diction was perfect. I've never heard anybody speak like that. And he was just a young Indian man. It was very weird, unusual, I would say. And so we're walking along and we're talking. And
so this is in the 80s.
This is in late
70s. 1975. 75.
1975. This is all happening in 1975. And so. This fortune teller approaches us as we're walking along. And it's an Indian man with a turban, you know, and he looks like a fortune teller. And he says, I can tell your past, your present, and your future. And so, you know, I mean, I didn't know what to make of it. So I look at this young Indian fellow that I'm with, and I say to him, is he good? You think it's, should I do this? He says, oh, yes, he's very good. Okay, why not? So it was a few rupees, whatever it was, and so he starts telling me about myself a little bit, and he tells me some things, nothing that really sort of sticks in my mind at this point. But then he says to me, he says that if you had the opportunity to wish for anything in the world, and that would be granted, what would you wish for?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought very quickly. I thought, well, I could say something sort of frivolous like win the lottery.
Yeah.
But then I thought, I'm here, you know, it's India, it's the mysterious land of snake charmers and fortune tellers. Because back in the 70s, there was mystery to the world. Now there's hardly any mystery because everything's on Google.
Mm-hmm.
But there was mystery in the world then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I'll give him a sincere answer. Like I thought very quickly, and I said, understanding, one word, like understanding.
Understanding.
That's what I asked for.
Oh.
Okay? That's what I said. And then he said something, and he said something about, something like God or something. Something about God.
Where did that come from?
Something about God, but I didn't, you know, I wasn't, I didn't believe in God, and I did not believe in God. I didn't know God, you know, like, you know.
But somewhere at the back of the mind, you all the time were looking for some answers. That's where understanding came, as a wish for life.
I quite agree. I mean, that's obviously, it was coming from somewhere, and it was there. It was definitely there. One of the things that Swami says that he puts people into difficult family situations because it inspires them to seek answers. And I was in a bit of a difficult family situation growing up as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without going into any details or anything, and it's nothing special. But that could have had something to do with it. I don't know.
Mm.
But in any event, that was the end of that, and so life goes on. So the travels continue, you know. I said understanding, he said something, and I didn't think much of it really, you know. It was just an interesting little experience with a fortune teller in India.
Hmm.
So I continue on the travels. Next stop from Calcutta, direct stop from Calcutta is Kathmandu in Nepal. And in Kathmandu, I met this young German fellow that we hooked up together with. We were traveling together, and we end up at this place called Nagarkot, which is at the foothill of the Himalayan mountains, the big Himalayan mountain range. So we find this little guest house, like a modest little guest house, and we get a room there. So we're sharing this room, and we go to bed, and then all of a sudden, like, I have this, I can only call it a visitation. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to call it, but I was aware that this elephant god was in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying to this traveling companion, I was saying, it's the elephant god. He's in the room. And then all of a sudden, I had this sort of awareness that came to me about, like, karma and past lives, a reincarnation, things that I'd never knew anything about before. It was like a complete revelation to me. But it was very real, and it was sort of something that, you know, like, that I understood when this happened.
So you actually saw Ganesha?
No, I didn't see Ganesha. But I just, like, I sensed, like, that it was Ganesha.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't call him Ganesha, I called him the elephant god.
But you sensed a very powerful feeling of his presence.
Yes, yes.
And then this knowledge just came.
Came.
Oh.
Came. And it was a huge eye-opener for me. Like, I'd never experienced or understood anything like that before. I'd never read about karma. I was very ignorant, you know, surprisingly, or not surprisingly, because I'm from the West. But in any event, so when that happened, I went back to Kathmandu after that, and I went into a Tibetan art shop, and on the wall, I saw this Tibetan painting of this elephant god. And so I thought, wow, there he is. And so I said to the shopkeeper, I said, who is that? And his words were, quote, he's the god of wisdom and understanding.
Oh my God.
And when he said that, like, everything, just like the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I was like, wow, you know, this is unbelievable. This is unbelievable. And so I never, like, I got to India again after that, but I didn't remember Sai Baba. I had to get back to Canada. I had to get back to work. That's basically what happened, eh?
Mm.
And so I didn't really see much of India at that point. I saw a little bit, like, you know.
So the first time, you know, there was a mention of Sai Baba to you by that medical student.
Yes.
He had mentioned the name. Did that name remain in your mind?
Not the full name. I just remembered a Baba.
A Baba, okay.
I remembered a Baba.
Okay.
But then I wasn't thinking of Baba.
You're not thinking about it.
No, I'm not thinking about Baba.
You heard about Baba, and then a lot of Ganesha experiences happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But the experiences, like they just really changed me completely. Mm-hmm. And when I got back, I started getting books that I could get books on every subject, like Eastern religion and Paul Brunton, Search in Secret India, and Alexandra Neal, and ESP, and you know, Flying Saucer. I was open up to like everything like that. I was reading everything I could get my hands on, and I studied. I was introduced to a Tibetan Buddhist teacher,
mm-hmm.
and so I studied Tibetan Buddhism with that teacher,
mm-hmm.
I used to go into these spiritual book shops in Toronto, and then I remembered this Baba.
Mm-hmm.
It came to me, like, this Baba.
Mm-hmm.
Now I came back in 1975, so this is now a couple of years going along,
mm-hmm.
and I remember this Baba. So I go into these bookshops, and I'd always, in the back of my mind, I'd be looking to see if I could find a book about this Baba, something, because I'd never met anybody.
So once you started reading a lot about these Eastern philosophy, again this Baba came back.
Exactly.
And you thought maybe you should explore.
Exactly. I thought it would be interesting to look into that. I'd be looking at books, and in the back of my mind, maybe there's a book about Baba. But Baba is a very common name, and there were a lot of gurus with the Baba named Baba.
Yes.
And so I remember finding a book about Mayor Baba in a bookshop, and I just opened it up and I started reading how he was hitting his devotees, disciples with sticks and stuff. And I said, no, that's not him. And then so finally one day, I see a book, on the shelf, and it's called Sai Baba, Man of Miracles. And so, I buy the book. I think to myself, that sounds like it could be the Baba. I think I'll get this book and I'll read it. So I bought the book and I took it home. I sat down and I started reading the book, and I got partway through, and then I just started crying like a baby, just crying, just sobbing, like crying. And so I put the book down and I sort of got back to normal, composed myself. And then I picked the book up, and I started crying like a baby again. Like the something came through the pages of that book that really, sort of penetrated right to the very core, know. But I'd never met anybody that ever heard of Sai Baba, like nothing. So right at that moment, I thought to myself, I have to go to India, because now I knew where he was in the book. I have to go to India. Back and check this out, because I don't know if it's true or not what was in that book, but if it's even 5% true, it's amazing, so I have to go to India again and to see Sai Baba.
But something that book did to you, it just completely softened your heart so much. Something happened at the core of your being when you read that book.
I think that this with hindsight, okay, with hindsight, but I think that like somewhere very deep in my consciousness or unconscious, I must have had some connection or something like that, maybe not with Sai Baba, but with that kind of teacher or master, and then all of a sudden, like reading in the pages of that book, like it's like that could be my master. That's how it felt, But I didn't know at that point, because I didn't know what to believe and not to believe.
It's like you come back home or something like that.
I come back home. But not even realizing where home was, I managed to take this is now 1979, 4 years later.
Okay.
I managed to take another 7 months from my law practice in Toronto.
Okay.
My destination was to see Sai Baba.
This time it was clear.
this time, that was my final destination.
Yes.
But I traveled through the similar route, through the Pacific and across Asia and whatnot, but my ultimate destination was to see Sai Baba. I went that route again for certain reasons, but it's not really relevant to this. So what happened was that I sort of retraced the route a little bit before I got to India, and I went back to Nagar Khat, just to that place where I had that, and I went back to Prambanan, but I went back to Nagar Khat, and by then I knew about Ganesha and everything, okay? And then I found out, I didn't see this the first time I was there in 1975, but this is like a lookout place for the Himalayan mountains range, and they had like a map of the peaks. And directly opposite where I was standing, there was a very large mountain peak, and on the map it was called Ganesh Himal, believe it or not.
Ganesh Mahal.
Ganesh Himal, H-I-M-A-L.
Ganesh Himal, okay, the Ganesh Mountain.
Yes, it was called the Ganesh Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, you know, more wow, there's a lot of wow here. And then I ended up back in Bali, and I went to the same guest house that I'd been at in 1975 to stay there in a place called Ubud, which is like sort of up, it's a bit high, and it's like an artist colony and whatnot. And I went back there, and the fellow who ran the place, who owned it, he said to me, he said, I'm looking after this villa for the Italian ambassador to Indonesia, and it's just through the rice fields and whatnot, these beautiful rice, terraced rice fields, and, it was like an idyllic setting. He says, if you might be interested in staying there, I can let you stay there instead of staying here. Well, here was just this simple little modest place.
Mm-hmm.
So I went with him, you know, it's a few minutes to get to this, unbelievable, sort of idyllic villa where it's where you see the volcano off in the distance, and you see all these terraced rice fields, and there's flowers growing everywhere, and there's it's just a beautiful place. There's a swimming pool there, and in the garden there's this big standing statue of Ganesha
there,
and He tells me that this compound here, this villa, it's called Ganesha House.
Oh wow!
but it doesn't end there, because what happened was that while I was there, I became a little bit like I wasn't feeling well.
Mm-hmm.
So there were two sort of cottages on this property, and I was in one, and then the other one was this Australian doctor. And I wasn't feeling well, so somebody called him over to look at me. And you have to understand that up to this point, I've never met anybody that's heard of Sai Baba. I've never, nothing except that book I read. And I was on my way to see Sai Baba. That was my destination. And so this doctor looks at me, and he says, well, there's not a whole lot I can do for you. You know, probably nothing, you know, serious. But here, let me give you this. And he takes out his wallet, and he opens it up, and he takes out a little packet, and he opens it up, and he says, here, take some of this. It's called Vibhuti, and it's from Sai Baba.
Oh, my God.
And one of my patients in Australia gave it to me. She was there to see Sai Baba, and she gave me this. She said Sai Baba gave it to her. So I took the Vibhuti, and I thought, wow, you know. And so what happens then after that, you know, to continue on, I end up in Bombay.
So you recover?
Oh, absolutely. It wasn't anything special. It was nothing much. So I end up in Bombay to go to Bangalore, to go to Puttaparthi. And so I get on the plane in Bombay to go to Bangalore. And this lady and her husband comes on, and she's wearing this white sari, this lady. And I remember reading that Baba was encouraging Western ladies to wear saris. So I just thought, I'll just see, you know, if maybe she's going there, you know, because then I'll have somebody maybe to point the way, whatever. Mm. So it turns out that she's a lady from Toronto.
Oh.
Where I was from, with her husband. And so we hook up together, and we get a taxi in Bangalore. And on the way from Bangalore to Puttaparthi, to Prashantanilayam.
So she knows all about Puttaparthi. She's come before.
She hadn't been before. This was her first time, but she knew where she was going.
Okay. Because
she had heard of Sai Baba.
Okay.
And so, because there had been, like, before we started our center, there were two other centers in Toronto at that time.
Okay.
But the center we started was sort of like a Western-oriented center, because the other two were mainly Indian people like that. Mm. So, on the way, she's teaching me bhajans and everything. And when I arrive, the first thing I see is a statue of Ganesha.
So finally, Ganesha has worked on you for so many years to bring it to my father.
So that's the first, you know. And then I'm introduced to this young man, and his family becomes instrumental in my family's life later on, when I have a family. I meet this young man there, and he just come out of an interview, and somebody said he's from Mississauga, which is near Toronto. So I went up to talk to him, and Swami had just materialized for him a ring with Ganesha on it.
Swami materialized.
Yeah, for him, for this young man. He was like about 18 years old. He was a young man. Anyways, on that trip, I had interviewed Swami, and some things happened. And then when I got back to Toronto, you know, I this lady told me to call her when I get back. So when I got back, I called her, and she was interested in starting a Sai Baba center for Westerners, basically. And she said that this young lady had called her as well, who was interested in getting involved, and she had just learned about Sai Baba in Hawaii, and that she was, and we were going to have a meeting of some people and to set up a center. And so I said, terrific, you know. So
you said you had an interview with Swami. You should tell us what actually happened.
Well, it's a couple of things happened in the interview. He talked to me like he gave me some spiritual teaching, you know. It was a private interview. He took me into the private interview room with an older lady. See, I wasn't as old back then. I was sort of a youngish type of fellow. And so he took me into the room with an older lady. And so there were two of us in the private interview room in the mandir there here in Prashanti. And so he spoke with me, and he said that something interesting would happen in my life or something, but I didn't know what to make of it, you know. Because when Swami talks, like, you know, it's hard to really, you know, you're just listening mainly, sort of. He said, I didn't know what to make of it at all. And then he asked me, you know, what do you want? So I said to him, I just want to be, I want to be near to God. So he kind of laughed, and he said, "Well, you're sitting at his feet." But then on that same trip, somehow I ended up at the home of Colonel Jugarao in Bangalore, and he happened to be there. It was a complete coincidence that I was in Bangalore and that he was where he was, at his house, and I don't even know how I found out where he lived. And they were building a building here in Prashanti, and so, you know, with a small donation, and it was a small donation, you know, he said that I could have a room in it, you know. So I thought, well, hey, that sounds like a pretty good investment. And then I never heard anything again for several years. And then I came here one time several years later, and the building was there, and I had a room. You know, and I think that room actually has been instrumental in sort of facilitating, you know, these regular trips here, you know. It's certainly been instrumental. But he said something interesting would happen, and like he held my hand and everything, and I was close to him, and, you know, everything. It was really, when I came out of there, I was in bliss for like a long time. I was up there somewhere, you know. But finally, you know, you come down. And so that was in 79. That was my first trip.
You came out of the interview room definitely a very different person, isn't it?
I would think so. Absolutely. But also, like as part of the whole experience of being there in 1979, I was there for sure.
By this time, you had read so much about Eastern philosophy and all that. You've introduced the concept of avatar, and isn't it? I mean, you've read a lot about all this.
Well, it wasn't so much about... I'd read about Indian sort of masters and gurus and things like that, you know, and yeah, I'd read a lot at that point for sure. But you know, reading is one thing, but part of the experience back then in 79 was my first trip there, and I came as a skeptic, basically. Mm. And I was a criminal lawyer for 8 years, and I govern myself by evidence, you know?
Mm.
Like it's got to be credible.
Mm.
And most people wouldn't think that, you know, what we're talking about is credible, but to me, like, I met all kinds of interesting people who told me all kinds of amazing stories, first-hand stories about, you know, incidents that they'd had with Swami and how it affected their lives and everything. And then I had that experience myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he materialized some Vibhuti or something like that, you know. So when I came away from there, the hook went in very deep, very, mm. very, very deep.
Mm.
And so when I came back to Canada, we set up this center. And because we had a center, there was the World Conference, in India in 1980. It was, the third World Conference. And because I was part of a center like that, so I was a delegate to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to arrange for a 3 month leave of absence from my practice, which is easy to do actually if you have other lawyers that you're working mm-hmm. with. And so we came here, and before I came to India, I went to see my parents to you know say goodbye, you mm-hmm. know, and my father had he'd suffered bad health for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
He was in his early 70s at that time, and he was almost a shut-in. Mm-hmm. Like he'd had heart attacks. Like his heart was so bad that he couldn't walk 100 meters without severe chest pains.
Oh, man.
So he was in the house most of the time. He lived in an apartment in Toronto. And he had problems with his digestion, and he had problems with his circulation, and he had ulcers. He had like the drugs when you went to visit were lined up on the kitchen counter, like, you know, a whole lineup of drugs.
Oh.
You know, and he was just being kept alive by these drugs, it would appear. But when I looked at him, I'd never seen him look so bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like he looked so frail and so weak. That I thought to myself, if I'm going to be away for 3 months, like there's a good chance that he's not going to make it for these 3 months.
Oh.
Like I was aware of that. So in any event, I came for the Third World Conference, and it was terrific, and we had a, you know, a wonderful time, and then Swami went to Madras to inaugurate the Sundaram Temple in Madras, so everybody, you know, people would follow him there, so I followed him there. So I was gone for a number of days. And then when I came back to the ashram, there was a letter waiting for me from home.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a letter from my mother, and it said that my father had suffered a heart attack.
Oh, my God.
So as soon as I got that letter, I thought to myself, well, that's good news and it's bad news. The good news was that he was still alive, but the bad news was, as far as I was concerned, that if he had a heart attack, there's no way that he's going to survive it. He was so weak and frail that no way was he going to survive it.
Mm.
And the letter had been written about 10 days before.
Oh.
Because it took that long to get here, and then, because that's 1980.
Mm.
It took that long to get here, and then I was in Madras for several days and everything like that. So what I did was I just went immediately to the telegraph office in the village, because back then there were no phones, the communications were very primitive.
Yes.
If you wanted to place a long distance call, they had a phone in the post office, an old phone. And if you were lucky, you might get through in a few hours or in a day or two days or whatever. That's how it was. Eh?
Yeah.
Which I didn't mind, because it, when you came here like that in those days, there were no distractions from Swami.
Yeah.
Now there's a million distractions. you were there, and you know that was your focus, eh?
Yes.
And it was terrific from that point of view, eh?
Yeah, yeah.
But in any event, I went immediately to the telegraph office, and I was sure that there was going to be a telegram from home saying that he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no telegram.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, that's good. So that day, I wrote a letter to Swami. And I sat in darshan, and like there were like four or five rows or something in those days, and it was on the sand, and so I got about the third row, and I had like a really good spot to give the letter to Swami when he came by, and he's coming along, and I have an opening there, it's perfect. I can hand him the letter, and he gets close, and this is looking, oh, I'm gonna get my letter to Swami. And just as he gets opposite, like about five or six men just jump up and go at his feet and everything else like that. And it's like pandemonium there.
Mm.
And I'm holding out my letter, and Swami, somehow he reaches his hand through this crowd of people that are trying to jump on him, and he snatches the letter from my hand.
Oh, wow.
So that was, I was very grateful for that. And then the next morning, I got into the first row in darshan, and Swami came by, and so I got up on my knees, and I said to him, Swami, I said, Swami, Father very sick. He says, I know. And then he waves his hand in the air, and he materializes Vibhuti, and he puts it in my hand, and he says, take it to Father, go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, go. So I put the Vibhuti in a package, And I immediately gathered together all my belongings. I got into Bangalore. I went to the airport the airline office. I booked a flight immediately to go back. I sent a telegram, to my mother telling her, you know, what my, flight arrangements were, when I was going to be arriving back at the airport in Toronto. So my mother, the trip back was actually kind of interesting, and I just digress a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because Swami had materialized the Vibhuti and told me to go to my father, I was quite confident by that point in Swami. I had enough confidence to really feel in my heart that everything was going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the trip back wasn't all that terrible. You know, I was actually almost looking forward to it in a sense, if you can understand that.
Mm. Because you just felt that when you have this huge support of Swami, he's given Vibhuti, so he's going to take care of you.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. And I'd met so many people that he cured of,
yes,
serious illnesses and everything, you know. Mm. And so I had a high level of confidence that this was going to be, it was going to be okay. So, but what happened was, and this is kind of interesting, like when I got to New York City, and my connection was, from, JFK, which is, is the international airport in New York City. And then you have to go to another airport, LaGuardia, which is where the flights to Toronto, mm-hmm, took from. And it's about a 20-minute taxi ride. So when I got into, JFK, there was this big long lineup of people trying to go through immigration. And I didn't have a lot of time to make my connection. I didn't have a lot of time at all. And so I went up to the front of the line, you know, because I was a bit desperate to get the connection. And I said, look, my father is dying and I have to get there. And they said, back of the line.
Oh.
Go back into the line.
Mm.
Yeah, they were just, you know, sort of heartless, really.
Yeah.
And so I had no choice. So I had to get into this big long lineup. And then by the time I got out of the airport, my flight was already supposed to have left.
Mm.
But I thought to myself, well, you know, I'll go anyways. Maybe it's still there.
Mm.
You know, you never know. So I got a taxi and I told the guy to go as fast as he could. And I got to LaGuardia Airport. And it was at night, and the place was almost deserted. And I went up to the counter, the airline counter where my ticket was, with Air Canada, I think it was at that point. And there was nobody there. It was like deserted.
Oh.
And there were two fellows behind the counter, and they were just packing up to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I showed up and I said, I'm here for this flight, they laughed. They laughed.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, God. And I didn't know what to do then, because then I'd have to rearrange, you know, and do, and I'm in New York City by, you know, by myself, and so I'd have to find a hotel. I didn't know what I would do, sleep in the airport, whatever I was going to do. So, and then I'd be late getting home. That was the worst part of it. So I turned to go away, and then one of the fellows says, just wait a minute, let me make a phone call. So he picks up the phone and he talks to somebody. He says, "Hey, guess what?" He says, "The plane's still there."
Plane's still there.
He says, "If you hurry, they're waiting for you." So I had my bag and everything, and I ran through the terminal to get to the airplane. And as soon as I got to the airplane, they closed the door. I sat down, and the plane took off for Toronto.
Oh my God! Quite a thriller.
Well, Swami likes drama. So, I got to the airport. My mother was waiting for me, and the first thing she says to me is, "You're here. You got our telegram." I said, "No, I didn't get a telegram. There was no telegram." She says, "Yes." She says, "We sent you a telegram several days ago. And it said that your father was gravely ill and he was not expected to survive."
And I
thought to myself, wow, you know, they had already been making the funeral arrangements.
Oh my God.
The doctors had said that he should have been dead several days before. And they were already making the funeral arrangements, but he was hanging on like by a thread. And so the next morning I went to the hospital and, I took the vibhuti that Swami gave me, and I took half of it and I put in a little bit of water and I poured it into his mouth. And then a little bit later I took the other half and I did the same thing. And then he just started getting better, like just instantly. Like he just started recovering, like, and coming back to life. And he just started getting better, you know, and he was now looking around and he was talking and he would eat something. And the doctors were amazed, and we got him up out of bed, and I was walking him in the hallway and stuff like that. So he was there for 10 more days, and then when we were leaving the hospital, the doctor came up to him and tapped him on the shoulder and said to him, he said, "Jack," my father's name, he said, "Jack, you're my patient of the month." So I didn't say anything, you know. I didn't want to rain on his parade, you know. He thought he was doing such a good job. He if it was up to him, my father would have been buried already, you know. But that's okay. but the amazing thing was that once we got him home, he kept getting better. Like, not only did he recover from that heart attack, but whereas he was a shut-in before and he couldn't walk, you know, 100 feet or, you know, whatever, without having to stop and with severe pains and that, so he wouldn't go anywhere. Now he could walk. Now he could eat. Now, you know, he could eat all different foods, like he didn't need his pills. I bought him running shoes.
Oh my God.
So that he could go like that, you know, and he was walking and doing things. And then he started driving and then he started.
It's like a new life.
A new life. And then he got a job doing volunteer work at an old age home in Toronto. And it was like a new life. But the thing is, I should point out that he thought I was a screwball.
Oh,
going off to India to see an Indian guru. You know, he thought I...
So he didn't believe that he recovered because of the vibhuti or anything like that?
I don't know.
He just felt that the doctors did their job well.
I think so. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. No, he didn't believe in any of this stuff, okay? And he thought I was a bit offside, wasting my time like that.
What about your mother?
My mother, on the other hand, realized that she had witnessed a miracle.
Oh, she realized.
Oh, she realized. And she had very strong feelings towards Swami. And she wanted to come to India to meet him and to thank him.
Oh, wow.
And I was more than happy to bring them. But we both knew, and my mother said that, you know, "I can't go unless your father agrees to come." And I thought to myself, and we both thought, that there's no way he's going to agree to come to India to see an Indian holy man. Like, that's, you know, it's not going to happen. But it happened. You know, we put it to him, and he said, okay, I'll come. You know, because I guess maybe the travel and maybe being a good sport, whatever, we wanted to come, so he was going to support us or whatever, you know what I mean, like that. So that's 1981.
So it's not as if he wanted to see Sai Baba or anything, but it's just that he thought he will also just tag along.
He'll go along for the ride, you know. He'll go along for the ride, and he'll just, because we want to go. So he's going to be a good guy, and he knew that my mother wouldn't go without him, and you know, yeah. So, but his heart wasn't in it, I'll tell you. Although his heart was quite a lot stronger than it was, you know, a little short time ago. And so this was a whole other adventure, because what happened was that I booked tickets for us to go to come to Puttaparthi, or to India anyways, to Bangalore, and just at the time that we were supposed to leave, there was a pilot strike that was imminent, and so we're in the airport, and already flights had been delayed and some canceled and stuff like that because the pilot strike was imminent. And my mom and I are looking forward to going, you know, we're really keen. And all of a sudden, like, we have a problem, you know, because now it's not certain that the plane is even going to get off. And so we're delayed. And we're sitting in the airport lounge, and we're delayed for quite a long time. And my father is now starting to get a bit upset, and he's saying, you know, I shouldn't have agreed to come on this trip. Like, look at what's happening here. We're sitting here, you know, we're not going anywhere. What a waste of everybody's time and money and everything, you know.
He was getting frustrated.
He's getting very frustrated. Very frustrated. And just when he was about to you know, really go off the deep end, the pilot or somebody comes on the loudspeaker and says, everybody board the plane.
Okay.
So we board the plane, and I think, oh, thank goodness we're going to get off. Fantastic. Because we had to go to New York and then to London and then to Bangalore. So we get on the plane, and I'm waiting for the plane to move, and it doesn't move.
Oh.
And now we're sitting on the plane, not in the lounge, for a long time.
Oh.
And he's now getting more upset. And then the pilot comes on and he says, folks, you're going to have to go back into the lounge and wait in the lounge.
Really?
So I think, oh my goodness, you know, what's happening? So we go in, and we're
it's such a difficult start. I think your father would have just lost all patience.
Tell me about it. So we're in the lounge, and time's going by, like not a little time, a lot of time.
Yes.
And he's working himself up, like he's getting upset, and this is, you know, finally it gets to the point where he says, I've had it. I'm not staying here another minute. I'm going home.
Oh.
And he gets up to go home. So we would have had to go with him, of course. At that moment, they come on again and they say, everybody get on the plane.
Oh. Just at that moment.
At that moment. So we get on the plane, and this time it moves.
Tune into Sai. Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay
tuned. Sai Ram, dear listeners, welcome back to Morning Glory on Thursday Live on this 19th day of April 2018. The time in the ashram in Prashantanilayam, India right now is exactly 43 minutes past 10 a.m. That is Indian Standard Time. You just heard part one of Tryst with Divinity, Under the spotlight was Mr. Bernard Kugelman of Toronto, Ontario, Canada, a criminal lawyer by profession, and he was in conversation with my colleague, Mr. Bishop Rushdie. So I'm sure you're curious to know what happened when they were sent back to board the plane for the second time, and I urge you to join me again next Thursday on Morning Glory to catch part two of this very interesting interview. Meanwhile, I ask you to please send your feedback to this morning's episode of Morning Glory as well as to any other Radio Sai programs. As always, we welcome your emails at listener@radiosai.org. And now it's time for me, as promised, to talk to you about the answer to the question I posed to our listeners this morning. Earlier on the show, I asked you, which campus of the Sri Satyasai Institute of Higher Learning was started as a college that was originally affiliated to the Sri Venkateshwara University in Tirupati in its early years? And I'm happy to say almost all of you, most of you got the answer right. Now, first, I'll just remind you, I was asking you which campus of the Satyasai University. Therefore, Brother Pratap Makodia wrote the Jawaharlal Nehru Technological University, but Brother from Bhavnagar, Gujarat. But Brother Pratap, that is not part of the Satyasai University. That's an independent university. So it has no affiliation with us and therefore will not be counted as the correct answer. However, thank you for trying. Very good guess. A good engineering college located in Anandpur. The correct answer is, and the first person to send me the correct answer was Jyoti Uchil from Mumbai. And Jyoti said, Anandpur campus is the first one that was started under Sri Venkateshwara University of Tirupati. Congratulations go out to Jyoti Uchil from Mumbai. Again, Rekha Loknath from Mysore, Karnataka said, obviously it's Anandpur College, which was affiliated to the Venkateshwara University. Not so obvious to everyone, but I'm glad you're so well informed, Rekha Loknath. Congratulations to you. Brother Ajay Rajan from Chennai said, if my memory goes right, and yes, Ajay, it does go right, because you also guessed it correctly by saying Anandpur campus was initially affiliated to SV University. Correct answer. Thank you, Ajay, for participating after a long time. Anandpur Girls Campus Institute is the answer from Mr. Chotelal Mirakhar. Yes, Mr. Mirakhar, your answer is right. The Anandpur Girls Campus of the Satyasai Institute of Higher Learning was the first college that was first started by Baba, and in his initial years it was affiliated to the Sri Venkateshwara University in Tirupati. Another correct answer comes to us from Padma Venkat, who says, the correct answer to this morning's question is Anandpur campus. Thank you, Padma. Your answer is right. Mridula Murthy is very well informed. She's a Balvikas guru. She gets all her answers right. And she says, the Sri Satyasai Institute of Higher Learning's Anandpur campus was initially affiliated. Thank you, Mridula Murthy, for your answer and your participation. And finally, we have one more answer from Mr. V. Murali, who says, have a blissful Thursday. Answer for today's question, Sri Satyasai Arts and Science College for Women in Anandpur. Very well said. That's what the campus was called in those days. And it was called the Sri Satyasai Arts and Science College for Women in Anandpur. And I'm sorry, we have a few more answers. One more, actually, from Sai Praveena in Bangalore, Karnataka. Sai Praveena from Bangalore says, I think it was SSIHL Anandpur campus that was affiliated to SV University in its early years. You're thinking right, Praveena. That was the campus. So congratulations and thank you for participating to all of you. And thank you for trying. And it is always good to know that our listeners are paying attention. And incidentally, you know why Anandpur is again and again in news this year. Because it's going to celebrate its golden jubilee in a few months from now. And right here on Morning Glory and right here on Radio Sai, from time to time you will be updated on this glorious moment and this historic importance and significance in the larger scheme of things, especially the educational renaissance that Bhagwan brought about so silently and so quietly. For me, Bhagwan Sri Satyasai Baba is the greatest feminist on the face of earth, because he believed in empowering women with the right kind of education and placing women's education on the forefront. Because as you may recall, the very first campus of the Satyasai University, or when Baba started institutes of higher learning, the first campus was for women. Because Swami knew, when you educate a woman, you educate an entire family. On that note, I thank you for your company, dear listeners, and I'm going to leave you, as always, with some wonderful music to put you in a blissful mood. And till we meet next Thursday, I urge you to please keep smiling, be happy, life is for the living, and hope to see you soon at home on the 24th of April. It's the day when all of us as sisters and brothers have to unite and pay our obeisance to the light that fills our lives with so much of brightness and shine. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
నేనెప్పుడు మీ వెంటనే జంటనే ఇంటనే ఉంటుంటాను. కనుక మీరందరూ కూడా ఐకమత్యంతో పనిచేయండి. నా సీట్ ఇక్కడ కాదు, నా సీట్ మీ యొక్క హృదయమే. కనుకనే మీరు ఎక్కడ ఉంటే అక్కడ కూడా స్వామి ఉంటున్నాడు.
స్వామి ఇస్ దేర్ వెరెవర్ యు ఆర్.
ఏ కొరతను మీకు జరగవు.
నథింగ్ విల్ హ్యాపెన్ టు యు.
ఏ విధమైనటువంటి అపజయాలు మీకు జరగవు.
యు విల్ నెవర్ హావ్ ఫెయిల్యూర్.
కానీ పరిపూర్ణమైన విశ్వాసంతో మీరు పనులు ప్రారంభించండి.
వర్క్ విత్ టోటల్ ఫెయిత్.
ఏ పని చేసినా కూడా ఇది భగవత్ కార్యంగా భావించండి.
వాట్ ఎవర్ యు మే డు గుడ్ వర్క్ టేక్ ఇట్ యాస్ గాడ్స్ వర్క్.
Thank you. एकोंकार सतनाम करता पूरक निरपार निर्वैर अकाल मूर्त अर्जुनी से भंग गुरु प्रसाद जप आद सच जुगाद सच है भी सच नानक होसी भी सच।
जय जय गोपाल जय जय राधा रमण हरि Vaikhe Guru, Vaikhe Guru Ji, bolo. Vaikhe Guru, Vaikhe Guru Ji, bolo. Vaikhe Guru, Vaikhe Guru Ji, bolo. Satyanam, Satyanam, Satyanam Ji, bolo. Satyanam, Satyanam, bolo. Satyanam, Satyanam, Satyanam Ji, bolo. Nitya nityan japiye tere naam ji bolo nitya nityan japiye satya naam satya naam satya naam ji bolo satya naam satya naam ji ram 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 ji bolo bolo rama 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 ji bolo Satyanam, Satyanam, Satyanam Ji, bolo Satyanam, Satyanam, Krishna, 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 Krishna Ji, bolo Krishna, 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 bol Krishna, 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 Krishna Ji, bolo Krishna, 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 Nitya Nityan Japiye Krishna Naam Ji, bolo Nitya Nityan Japiye Hari, 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 Hari Ji, bolo Bolo Hari 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 Ji Bolo Satyanam 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 Ji Bolo Satyanam 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 Ji Bolo Govind Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Govind Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Radha Ramana Hari Govind Jai Jai Govind Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Govind Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Govind Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Bolo Govind Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Govind Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Bolo Govind Jai Jai Gopala Jai Jai Radha Ramana Hari Govind Jai Jai Vahe Guru Vahe Guru Vahe Guru Ji Bolo Vahe Guru Vahe Guru Bolo Vahe Guru Vahe Guru Vahe Guru Ji Bolo Satyanam 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 Ji Bolo Satyanam 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 Ji Bolo Satyanam Satyanam Satyanam, Satyanam, Satyanam.